Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Almost 100 years after his death, Jack London remains one of the greatest American storytellers of his time. His 1903 best-selling novel, The Call of the Wild, is still read by thousands of high school students across the country. In his career, spanning just 20 years, Jack London published 50 books, hundreds of short stories, and a number of essays. Millions knew Jack London as an influential fiction writer. He was the first American writer to earn $1 million. In her new book, Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America, Vanderbilt University professor Cecilia Tichy writes, quote, Jack London is often hailed as a prolific producer of fiction, a flamboyant adventurer, a daring sailor, a travel writer, and socialist essayist. But one issue that is fundamental to understanding his work and its significance to America's historical development, however, has been lost in successive decades. And that is, Jack London was a great American public intellectual, end quote. Cecilia Tichy explores why Jack London's socio-political influence has been overlooked in the United States, especially in light of his international reputation as an admired and respected figure in American social and political history. Cecilia Tichy is professor of English and American Studies at Vanderbilt University. She is the author of 7 books, including Civic Passions, Exposés, and Excess, and Embodiment of a Nation. And her newest book is Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America. Hi, Cecilia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Glad to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you, and I loved reading your book. I had no idea that Jack London fought for such a wide range of issues. He cared so much about economic inequality. He cared about exposing what was happening in the prison industry and the prison system. He cared about child labor, the exploitation of workers. And your main argument is that we need to talk about him as a public intellectual. Where did the idea for this book come from?
Well, it's so interesting. It comes out of a previous book that you mentioned, Civic Passions, and it was a kind of group profile of 7 people who helped bring our country out of the first Gilded Age and into the progressive era. Now, those 7, unlike Jack, those 7 were pretty much from upper middle class households, families. London differs from them in that he was a child laborer. He had in his muscle memory the experience of what it meant to work in a mill, to work in a cannery, to shovel coal in a basement into fiery furnace, and this a job in which he had been promised that if he started at the bottom, he would rise the way Horatio Alger Jr.'s heroes always seem to rise. London realized as his wrists swelled and throbbed, as he wrapped them with leather straps and kept shoveling, realized that he was being paid less than the 2 men who previously had that job, and that he would never rise in that toilsome manual labor job. He'd been fooled, he'd been gulled, seduced, so to speak, by the American myth, as he realized it was, of the Horatio Alger, and that he knew he was not alone. There were hundreds of thousands just like him, underpaid, overworked, and not just work, but toiling. London called himself a work beast and saw that throughout America, other young men and women were similarly categorizable. He vowed that he would then write, when he began to write, about these issues, and he would bring them to the American public's attention so that change could be made, so that the Gilded Age would not be America's last age.
And so, unlike the people who are now considered public intellectuals who were writing side by side with Jack London, he actually experienced these jobs. I mean, he had a near-death experience because he worked so hard under brutal conditions.
He did, Rose. The others, you know, and let's just pause a minute and say, public intellectual, what does that mean? It means somebody who's got the attention of a broad range of the public and for purposes that are precisely about the well-being of the public. Now, most such figures were attached to officialdom, let's call it. They had the pulpit, they had academic prestige, they might even be in business. Andrew Carnegie could be arguably one such because he wrote about wealth and so on. But London, as a fiction writer, is not ordinarily regarded, nor is any fiction writer, because somehow our historians and our political scientists, who I think should pay some attention to the influence of fiction in our historical kind of profile, tend not to. They're going for quantitative figures, and they can't seem to grab them out of a novel or a short story, so they just bypass, with three exceptions, I would say. Uncle Tom's Cabin, in relation to the Civil War. Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, in relation to food safety especially, though it's about other things as well. And very recently, about Ayn Rand, The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, Alan Greenspan, our Federal Reserve chairman until recent years, proclaims his love of and influence by Ayn Rand, and so does the new Speaker of the House of Representatives, Paul Ryan. So we see public figures who attribute to the power of fiction some of their guiding ideas. A century ago, those ideas were Jack London's, and he was very explicit about what to think and why he thought it and why America should join with him.
Why do you think it's important to consider Jack London a public intellectual?
Well, for one thing, Rose, he reached millions with his stories and his novels. Once The Call of the Wild was published, that's 1903, that's the book that burst on the national scene, made him famous. Now, in part, that publication was keyed to a precise moment in American culture. We had a new middle class who had leisure time and leisure discretionary money, could buy books, could afford themselves entertainment. So in the evenings, to read a magazine, read a book, and there was popularity concerning exotic faraway places. So here was Jack London. He'd been to the gold rush in the Yukon in 1907-08, didn't do very well trying to find gold. His gold were the stories that he kind of gleaned from listening to the miners and seeing the Inuit people and their dogs, and he milled all that into his stories. But he did something that hasn't sufficiently been recognized, and let me stick with that very novel for a minute. Is that okay? Can I talk a little more about Call of the Wild?
Yes, please.
All right, okay.
Yes.
You know, as you mentioned, it's taught in high schools, read by thousands of young people in America today. It is celebrated as a kind of hymn to American individualism and freedom because, as you know, at the very end, the hero dog, Buck, escapes into the far north, becomes a kind of mythic figure, an iconic figure, and seems right in sync with our highest values. But if we look at the long middle of that novel, we see that hero dog is a work dog strapped into the harnesses with fellow workers. They are driven beyond exhaustion by bosses, mushers, who lash them with whips, who beat them with clubs, who don't feed them enough, so that if one gets enough to eat, another is deprived, and that sets up rivalries. At one point, London says of them, the dogs together, that they're singing a song in a minor key, anybody in music knows that a minor key tends to be sad and plaintive. They are, quote, pleading for life. And London calls them also, these dogs trapped in their harness, perambulating skeletons. I think that many of the readers, not all, but many, saw that this was an Aesop's fable for their era. These were industrial workers caught in a low-wage, exhausting condition of industrial America in which some would not even survive. One dog, its muscles beyond recuperation, is cut loose from the harness and left to die in the snow and ice. And the phrase is, it is got rid of. So London was using these dogs as a way to reach his readers. Again, not everybody, but those who could take hold of his deeper meanings realize this was no way for America to proceed. Something had to be done. New regulations, better pay, better housing, better terms of hours, because London himself had worked for 10 cents an hour for shifts that ran 14, 16 hours. Whenever the boss said, finally, you can leave now, that's when somebody left. So London embedded in his fiction messages for the public and messages that were meant to prompt activism.
Cecilia Tichy is author of the new book, Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America. Jack London died when he was just 40 years old, and he published 50 books, hundreds of short stories, a number of essays. He was such a popular writer in the U.S. He was the first American writer to make $1 million. And Cecilia Tichy argues that Jack London should be remembered as and talked about as a public intellectual because he fought for a more equitable and just society. And he has Bay Area roots. He grew up in Oakland. He lived in Oakland. And then he entered the University of California at Berkeley for one semester before spending the Klondike Gold Rush winter of 1897 to 98 in the Yukon. And then when he returned, he committed himself to become a professional writer. So what do you know about Jack London? If you've read his books, how did they affect you? And did you know much about his political activism? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Cecilia Tichy is professor of English and American Studies at Vanderbilt University. And Cecilia, you wrote, and this is so interesting, that Jack London grew to realize that he must use his fiction to educate the public about the development of a system of wage slavery that a generation after the Civil War bound workers to corporate masters. And unlike Upton Sinclair, who pummeled readers with a constant barrage of industrial society's horrors on nearly every page of his fiction, Jack London preferred to pace his messages, to touch down throughout his narrative with graphic exposition that alternated with glancing blows and subtle jabs. So how did he come to realize that fiction was the better way to actually reach people about these issues?
Well, let's consider, Rose, what fiction does. For one thing, it brings the reader into a world different from her or his own, and the reader dwells in that world, begins to be empathetic toward some characters and, of course, not toward others. In short, fiction not only reaches the cerebral part, the mind, it touches the heart. And London knew this. Now, as you're pointing out, he had to be careful. His fellow writer, Stephen Crane, author of The Red Badge of Courage, Crane said, preaching is fatal to art in literature. Preaching. You want a religious message, go to a house of worship. So London knew better than to preach. And also, the dean of American Letters at the time, William Dean Howells, cautioned that the public did not like to read about the vulgar life of toil. So London, in a way, was in the middle of these two warnings, and he knew that his readers had to find what in the market they bought. Adventure, excitement, romance. They wanted to dwell for a while in other places, even other times, because London wrote some historical fiction too. But London used a phrase that I think is key to his message in fiction. He said he wanted to stir a noble discontent, a noble discontent. Noble because the best of ethical and moral conscience would be stirred, and the discontent would be to see in the fiction stories in which underdogs deserved a better chance. And so a noble discontent could activate, possibly, readers' urge toward, dare I say, reform. And indeed, in the Progressive era, and London was writing right on through deeply into the 1910s of the Progressive era, there began to stir legislation to protect children, to create safer workplaces, even to raise wages. President Theodore Roosevelt, in a strike, coal strike in 1902, in support of the coal miners who were just desperate for higher wages, the president backed the workers, and so did the public for a change. Usually the public was not, the middle class and upper middle class public was not behind the workers. So London was using his fiction to stir that noble discontent and help our country get into a progressive era. So that, let's remember, when Woodrow Wilson ran for the presidency in 1912, he ran as a progressive.
And also, didn't Jack London's wife say that when he wrote nonfiction essays, he would be called an anarchist, a communist, a socialist, and his book sales would plummet? And at that time, they realized, oh, well, the public will accept the fiction, but not the nonfiction essays.
Rose, you've got it. And that is what his wife, Charmian London, his second wife, a much more successful marriage than the first, she kind of correlated his book sales, his magazine sales, acceptances, in relation to any lectures he had been giving or essays he had been writing. So back into fiction, quite right. You know, you mentioned that the isms, communism, anarchism. It's helpful for us to pause for just a minute and ask, what did London mean when he called himself a socialist? Mm. Because London rejected communism. He said it will never work. And he rejected anarchism. He just thought it was crazy. But socialism, he said, has two principles. One, are we not social beings, we humans? Yes, we are. Don't we live together? Yes, we do. Second point, shouldn't we live under a better, more equitable organization than the one we now have? So fiercely competitive that rivals destroy themselves in their competition. So corrupt that criminals and some businessmen who work with them for convenience, create a cities of corruption. We think of Boss Tweed. That word, I think, still has resonance. Politicos stealing from the public. I mean, London saying, socialism, shouldn't we live together under a better social, political, economic system than the one that now governs us? So those were his two principles. But as you're indicating, his adversaries, including the capitalist tycoons, would find it very convenient to merge all these isms, anarchism, communism, socialism. They're all horrible isms that afflict us and endanger us. And so failing to separate them out, as London always tried to do, it made it difficult for him to clear a space and define socialism as so different from these others.
Cecilia Tisci is author of Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America, and we'll definitely talk about the conversation we have about the isms in today's society. But we've got full lines, Cecilia, so I want to take a few calls before break. Let's go to Curtis in Berkeley. Hi, Curtis. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. Well, it's a very interesting show, and thank you for bringing your guest along. I missed her name, but...
It's Cecilia Tisci.
Ah, well, thank you. I'm kind of a student of his, and I ran into Tales of the Fish Patrol, which is a wonderful set of stories of when he worked for the Fish Patrol trying to control overfishing and stuff, and just tremendous series of stories that have features in the bay that, you know, people can recognize today. It's a wonderful thing. And his book, Scarlet Plague, main character, it had been a professor at the university, and this plague came along, and civilization was reduced to nothing, and he was kind of left to lament the loss of civilization. And his most disturbing book was The Iron Heel, in which, you know, the current course of events in which, you know, people get richer and richer and had reached a kind of a point that... it was illegal for the workers to read and to know how to read, and it was some people that were trying to fight against it, and eventually, you know, I guess they were all killed off. It was a very sad story, but it's quite a range of in his attitudes from when he was young and worked for the Fish Patrol, and kind of very interesting, you know, almost lighthearted stories to kind of really depressing. And I happen to know that he was, you know, he gave speeches around in Berkeley in the socialist theme, and he was giving a speech at Finn Hall over here in West Berkeley and was raided by the police.
Mm. Well, Curtis, thank you for that call, and I'll ask Cecilia about that in just a minute. I just want to take one more caller, and then we'll get a response. Let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Good morning, Rose and Cecilia. I'm so glad to hear about your book, Cecilia, because Jack London was one of the main people responsible for my learning to read. I'd probably be illiterate today if it hadn't been for reading Jack London's wonderful books like Call of the Wild and White Fang. Like a lot of young boys, I resisted reading. And if it wasn't for the sports pages and Jack London, I would probably still be struggling today.
Hmm.
So I greatly appreciate hearing about your book on him, and I will certainly read it. I have a question, though. Since Jack London kind of grew up in the school of hard knocks, what persuaded him that he could be a writer?
A great question. And we have to take a quick break, and I'll ask Cecilia right after we come back. Also, since we have two calls kind of about writing, definitely yours, John, Jack London's mom taught him to read at age 4. He loved reading. He always had librarians in the Oakland Public Library help him select books. So after the break, I'll also find out what he liked to read at a young age. He was the first American writer to earn $1 million. By 1903, millions knew the name Jack London as an influential fiction writer. But today's guest, Cecilia Tisci, argues that Jack London was so much more than a best-selling author. He was an avowed socialist, and she says he's one of the country's foremost public intellectuals who fought for a more just society. So we're going to talk after the break a little bit more about his political activism. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your Call here on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. If you'd like to join today's conversation, the toll-free call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC. At noon today, it's Backstory, and then at 1, Alternative Radio here on KALW San Francisco, Local Public Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about efforts to raise awareness about Native American history. This month is Native American Heritage Month, but a lot of people don't know that because it's hardly in the news. And Native Americans say that the truth about genocide has been covered up for far too long, but we are starting to see gradual changes from the classrooms to cities that now celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day rather than Columbus Day. So do you think that our conversation around Native Americans and Native American history is changing? That's tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Cecilia Tichy. She is professor of English and American Studies at Vanderbilt University. She's the author of 7 books. Her latest is Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America. And if you'd like to join us, what do you know about Jack London? If his writings affected your life, we'd love to hear from you. And what are your thoughts on Cecilia's main argument that he needs to be remembered as a public intellectual because he fought for a more just society? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Cecilia, what about John's question? After Jack London spent so much time toiling in factories and, you know, being treated so poorly and making very bad wages, what persuaded him to eventually become a writer?
Rose, both John and Curtis raise terrific issues. Tales of the Fish Patrol, White Fang, Call of the Wild. If we look back, and you said yourself, London was reading by age four. His mother taught him to read. She was an educated woman. He loved to read anthropology, adventure, a book that he especially felt close to by Mary Louise Ramey, a very popular writer of the late 19th century. It was a book titled Signa, and it's about a little Italian peasant mountain boy who makes good. And that was a kind of model, I think, for Jack London, that he, in a sense, an American peasant boy. His stepfather, John London, was a farmer. Much of the time, London himself remembered sitting on potato wagons as the horse plodded on. And so London was a reader from the moment he could read at four. His friends said about him, he read morning, noon, and night in the playground at school. He had a book in his hands. Now, what turned him to writing? One key event. The San Francisco Call, a newspaper, ran a contest for so many words or less of an experience. Jack said his mother kept him up with coffee all night while he wrote about an experience as a young sailor off the coast of Japan when a storm struck a typhoon. Typhoon off the coast of Japan. The prize was $25, and remember, a nickel was pretty much the dollar of that day. $25, Jack won, and he beat a Stanford student who got second prize. So that was one glimmer of how it might be. Jack also mistakenly believed that writers were paid 10 cents per word. Well, they were paid by the word, often for magazines. It's still the case in some publications. But he was quite mistaken. He was toiling, of course, for 10 cents an hour. And when he came back from the gold rush, from the Klondike, in 1898, for one thing, his health was seriously impaired. He had barely got out of there with before succumbing to scurvy, and wrecked his teeth, and I think his body was ever after never quite as robust. He comes back to Oakland. His mother sets an attic room for him. She was kind of a gambler. And he decided to try to make it as a writer because he saw that otherwise, in manual labor, he would be killed by exhaustion. He said, a capitalist multiplies his or her wealth over years, by age 50, perhaps rich. A worker, his or her capital is muscles, and by age 50, that capital is depleted. And ready, as London said, that worker is ready for the glue rendering works like an old horse. So London, it was his last lifeline. Maybe he could make it as a writer, and his mother backed him. He had one fork in the road. He had taken a civil service test for postal work. This was the 1890s. The country was sunk in a horrendous depression. It lasted 6 or 7 years. Jobs really scarce, but here London scored well enough on the civil service exam that he was offered a position in the U.S. Postal Service. He thought about it. He asked, could he postpone the decision? No, he could not. And his mother, the gambler, backed him as a writer, and that was the fork in the road. He turned down the Postal Service, writing 16, 18 hours a day up in that attic. I'm sure it wasn't insulated. Sending out manuscripts, and they bounced back, boomeranged right back. Postage itself wasn't cheap. The Londons didn't have much money. Scraping together enough for stamps to send the manuscript out again. I know, Rose, I'm kind of going on, but let me just say, here were the breaks. Two stories. One in the Overland Monthly, which at the time was a very high-toned magazine out of San Francisco. The other, the Atlantic Monthly on the East Coast, still going today. Those were the big breaks, and after that, London was selling stories. He was selling an early novel, but then came in 03, The Call of the Wild. But he had paid his dues. He'd been writing for a good 5 or 6 years steadily. He joked that he had tried to get away from manual labor, and instead he was laboring just as hard, learning to be a writer. Mm.
Well, steadily is an understatement, because he died at the age of 40 in 1916, and he wrote 50 books, which is incredible. Today we're speaking with Cecilia Tichy, author of Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America. Cecilia is professor of English and American Studies at Vanderbilt University, and she has just done extensive research on Jack London's life. She spent a lot of time at the Henry Huntington Library in San Marino, where 50,000 documents are now housed that reveal so much of who Jack London was. And we'd love to hear from you. If he affected you, if you've read his books, what are your thoughts? What do you think about Cecilia's argument that he should be remembered as a public intellectual who really fought for social justice in the United States? We'll also talk about what he thought about U.S. foreign policy, because he took trips to the South Pacific and Hawaii, where he saw U.S. imperialism and had very strong opinions about that. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to Cynthia in Berkeley. Hi, Cynthia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you so much for this book. I'm so excited to buy it and read it. Bit of a Jack London scholar. And I had two questions. The first is, The Iron Heel is my favorite Jack London novel, and I don't see it as the previous caller said. I think it is a hopeful message about the potential for revolution in the United States, because if you read the preface, he talks of it's written from the future time when the revolution has succeeded. So I'd like to know your opinion of the book, and if you agree. And the other thing is, are you going to be speaking anywhere in the Bay Area?
All right. Thank you, Cynthia. First off, do you have any speaking engagements in the Bay Area coming up, Cecilia?
I wish I did. If you have any ideas, Cynthia, send them along. Send them along. I have been out speaking. I'll tell you what you might do. If you will go online, look at Jack London, my name, and Jack London book. I was taped on C-SPAN just a couple of weeks ago, and it's now posted. so you can watch me for an hour saying some of the same things that we're talking about today. But let me go to the Iron Heel, because you're the second caller to bring it up. In the Iron Heel, and the caller profiled it exactly right, the oligarchic corporate and military have taken over, suppressed real free speech and any political activism. University professors have been fired, turned into really street people, because there's no way to make a living because the corporate oligarchy rules. Now, when Hitler's National Socialist Party, the Nazis, rose in the 30s, there were many critics who felt that Jack London had been prophetic about Nazi Germany, and that the Iron Heel was really his prescient vision of what would happen in Germany. Now we might ask, what about the corporate oligarchy? To what lengths might some of the fossil fuel businesses go to maintain their power? To what extent might the media, the mainstream so-called media, become captive by way of advertising and by way of hiring and firing, control the messages? London, in the Iron Heel, called the corporate tycoons and all of their vassals, because he thought this was a version of feudalism, that the Middle Ages had come roaring back. And we might ask that today. He called them well-dressed savages. And so the Iron Heel, it's a very stark novel. It's a very, as John the Caller, I believe, said, a distressing and even depressing novel, because at the end, the forces of good, of well-being, of social democracy and equality are crushed. I think it's one of Jack London's strongest warnings about what can happen if citizens, as Senator Sanders is now saying, if citizens in great numbers do not arise and take hold and really make their presence known.
He went to Hawaii in 1915 and 1916. He also went to the South Pacific and saw imperialism at work. Native Hawaiians were displaced when the whites took over and, you know, took over the sugar and pineapple plantations. He saw the oppression of Native peoples. Did he ever write about Native Americans? I mean, San Francisco and the gold rush. I mean, I was thinking about this while reading your book, if he ever wrote about that. He also had a big ranch in Glen Ellen, which was right in the middle of Indian country. Were you able to find anything about that?
You know, Rose, I did not. That's not to say that it doesn't exist. In his tales of the Klondike and the Yukon, we see Native peoples being represented, some heroically, some flawed. I mean, they are people. But I don't know that he wrote about the mainland Native Americans, and I know your show is coming up on that topic and at this very time of the year. But I would say that London always cared about the underdogs. And he was sometimes called a racist, and rather flippantly. And I think it's useful to bear in mind that London was born 1876, the same year there was a big blowout celebration in Philadelphia commemorating the 100 years from the Declaration of Independence, America on the world stage. Exhibitions of consumer products of every kind, Steinway pianos, crystal glassware. But there was also an exhibition of taxidermed animals together with Native American artifacts called artifacts of the Red Man, so that stuffed animals and the Red Man were all one. London, when he reached maturity, sometimes used racist language, but he included whites in his critique. He saw in the South Sea Islands the decay of life economically and in health, terms of health, by the native peoples, and he said that that the whites were agents of rot. And he saw that the white encroaching merchants, business people, military, he saw their theft of what the indigenous populations had at hand, and he said the white are looters, L-O-O-T-E-R-S. So in answer to your question, I don't think he did deal with, especially the U.S. now, U.S. West, but he was such an advocate of the underdogs, those who had succumbed to oppression, that I think we could project what he would say.
And Sam in Oakland has a question about racism. He says, please address the blatant racism Jack London espoused, especially in regard to yellow peril and his defense of the great white race ideology during the 1910 Johnson-Jeffries boxing match. Please do not brush this under the rug.
Well, I'm glad that that has come up, because just recently I reread London's dispatches from Reno, Nevada, 1910, over the July 4 weekend. London had seen the white Jim Jeffries box. He knew that Jeffries, white boxer, was no match for Jack Johnson, an endlessly smiling black master. That's London's word. When they fought, London hoped that the white boxer would win Jim Jeffries, but he was under no illusions, and he made no excuses for Jeffries. Johnson was clearly the winner. He was clearly the better boxer. London hoped that in the future there would arise a white boxer who might defeat Jack Johnson. It was a racially fraught championship match, but if you read carefully those dispatches, you see that London, who hated lies, hated excuses, he pulled no punches, saying how masterful Jack Johnson was in beating Jeffries, and so that kind of endless smile that the black Jack Johnson had on his face at all times would stay. Let me mention, just a few years earlier, there was a well-known painting, an oil painting, called Members of This Club, and it shows, and I'm having a little block about the author, I mean the painter. Here's the thing. A black and a white boxer are going at it. The black boxer has just bloodied the lower jaw of the white and is preparing to win. Members of this club, it's like a forecast of what would happen that 4th of July weekend in Reno. So London, yes, he uses the N-word, and it was everywhere at the time. He saw in Hawaii, and Rosa, I'm telling because one more part of this. What about London and East Asians? When London was in Hawaii at the islands, on the islands, he saw how many Japanese people were remaining after they had fulfilled their contracts as pineapple and sugarcane plantation workers. He saw the Japanese and Chinese, too, starting and flourishing successful businesses in Honolulu and elsewhere. He thought that there would come a time when Japan would make its bid for the Hawaiian Islands. And as we know, that happened on December 7 of 1941.
Cecilia Tisci is the author of Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America. And let's hear from Kevin in Alameda. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Okay, so I am the great grandson of the sea wolf. That's Wolf Larsen. And, you know, there's a lot of family legend around Jack and the wolf's real relationship. Of course, how they met in the book and their relationship in the book was fictional. But those two played hard together. They sailed to Hawaii. They grabbed a bunch of sugar. They went up to Alaska. I'm not sure if it was during Prohibition or what, but they had refineries up there to then take the rum down to San Francisco. And there were many, many trips and drunken adventures together with those two. But Wolf was a stone-hard capitalist, and you know, he was very much like the sea wolf in the book.
Well, thank you for calling in.
I'm so glad to hear the sea wolf come up as another title. Anytime anybody asks me what should I read that I haven't read of Jack London's, I say, how about the sea wolf? They love it. Everybody loves it. It is one wonderfully adventurous novel, but that captain is a captain of industry, so to speak. So when we look at business novels of the time, Frank Norris wrote one, The Octopus. Theodore Dreiser wrote The Financier series and was trying to get at the psychology of the business tycoon. Jack London's The Sea Wolf belongs, I think, in that list, because that captain, after all, the captain is the dictatorial master of everything that goes on a ship. His word is the word of God on that ship. So London puts in the industrial age, and he uses that phrase for that novel. It's in the middle of the novel there. Wolf Larsen is a kind of captain of industry, dictatorial, amoral, willing to use any and all of the crew to further his own interests. And London populates that novel first with a man and then with a woman. They come from the upper middle class, and I think that novel includes a lesson. America, upper middle class, toughen up and take a stand against this dictatorship of these captains of industry. And in the novel, those two really do. And I think that's London's kind of lesson for American, the affluent Americans. Get out of your chairs, get down in the trenches, and then take hold and help us get out of this gilded age.
Cecilia, I usually don't like sort of what would he think today questions, because there's no way you could have known. But because you were doing so much research about Jack London, and you found that, you know, he would often wonder, a million people are not properly fed or housed. How can this be in this rich country? 80,000 children at that time were working in textile mills. How can this be in this country? And what are your thoughts about, you know, the research you did back then and where we are today with massive inequality? Many cities across the country are declaring a state of emergency because the homeless problem is so bad. You've got massive, massive profits at a time when wages are stagnant and people, you know, can't make ends meet. So what was that like for you to see, kind of read about what Jack London was talking about and dealing with, and then looking at what we're dealing with today?
Well, Rose, you started our conversation by asking, how did you get into this book? And I think what drew me to Jack London was the first Gilded Age and how it compares with our second Gilded Age. It's become a commonplace to say, oh, yes, we're in a new Gilded Age. Google it, and the word comes up all the time. Wealth inequality that is so staggering. It's almost you almost can't get your head around it. So, if we ask, you know, is this the permanent state of things? Are U.S. workers not going to have stable employment? Is a worker going to have to over a 2-day period find out what the schedule is for the next 3 days, hoping there is a schedule? Are wages going to be so low that you really still can't get by on them, even when they're bucked up Are the tycoons going to tycoon their way around the planet in charge? Is this it? If we go back to Jack London, and this, in a sense, drove me back, the first Gilded Age, so many of the conditions that we're still faced with, including, and you mentioned this, a prison system that finally there's some movement on reforming it. 2.2 million people incarcerated, so many for nonviolent drug offenses, even while marijuana is legalized in state after state, and our industrial agriculture, in which we have monocrops, we have runoff that is toxic, so and on and on. But look back that century ago, the first Gilded Age, it segued into the progressive era, and I would say up to the New Deal, when we got legislation helping children in school stay out of the workplace, helping with wages, helping with workman's compensation, with disability compensation, Social Security benefits, so that children who were orphaned would be supported financially. So in a sense, we could say some of these socialist ideas that London and other reformers, too, were working on in that Gilded Age led to the Progressive Era, led further to the New Deal. And so once that could happen in the past, it could happen again. What people arrange, people can change.
Cecilia Tisci is author of Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America. She's professor at Vanderbilt University. Cecilia, thanks so much for joining us.
Rose, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll talk about efforts to raise awareness about Native American history. Most people don't know that November is Native American Heritage Month. It's hardly in the news. Native Americans say the truth about genocide has been covered up for too long, but we are seeing gradual changes from the classroom to cities that now celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day rather than Columbus Day. So is our society's conversation around Native Americans changing? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.